You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the holidays will look different for a lot of people this year. We'll learn how to find joy in them anyway. Now, school districts around the state are evaluating whether it's time to resume in-person instruction. Many schools suspended in-person classes for the fall semester to help minimize the spread of COVID-19. Others have opted for a combo of in-person and virtual learning. Some continued meeting in person. With research showing that children are less likely to get COVID, districts are considering reopening their doors. Just recently, the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said in-person classes should be the goal and said with vaccinations wrapping up, next fall could look something close to normal at schools and college campuses. Chippewa Falls Elementary Schools plan to reopen starting January 4th. Middle and high schools there will remain virtual through the 21st. In Appleton, the youngest students will go back 5 days a week on January 19th. Older students will return with a hybrid approach. Madison schools say they'll make a decision by January 8th. Just a few of the decisions out there right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is it time to return to in-person learning? Are you still nervous about COVID? How confident are you that schools can make learning safe? Are you worried about your kids being behind because they weren't physically at school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alan Borsuk is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, good to have you back with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, there's obviously arguments on both sides. First, can you talk about what we know so far about the impact of virtual learning on the kids who are learning online, not in schools?
Well, I think the big picture is there aren't any good choices here, and nothing is slam dunk better than the other, than anything else. So the virtual learning, I'm not aware of any Wisconsin results, but there's been an increasing amount of data coming in from around the country and even from overseas that suggests that overall reading isn't as bad as far as learning loss as was feared, but math, there's some pretty substantial learning loss. And more troubling, I would say, that the kids who were better off in the first place, including economically, are the ones who are getting the least penalty of being in such disruptive circumstances. And then the ones who most need to make progress, the ones with the most trouble reading and math and other basic skills, are the ones who are most likely to be losing grounds here. So it's not a pretty picture.
And then on the other hand, talk about the downsides of staying open, reopening, or, bouncing back and forth.
Well, the plus on the virtual side, of course, is that it much minimizes the chances of spread of COVID, which is the reverse for in-person schools, that almost every school that I know of has had some incidence of cases among kids, among teachers, among families, the parents and such, that have caused quarantining. A lot of schools have had disruptions of closing for a day or a week or 2 weeks or closing certain classes. Every day is a new adventure, and it's highly stressful for everyone involved, especially the leaders of the schools. You know, what are we doing tomorrow? Sometime minute to minute, you'll get something and say, oh, man, well, that's the end of this peaceful day. So it's been highly stressful. Teachers are stressed. Kids are stressed. Parents are stressed. That said, it's been actually working, it seems, fairly well as far as being able to conduct classes in the places where it's been 5 days a week particularly.
And we've seen a lot of research suggesting that kids, I think, clearly less vulnerable to COVID-19, especially the younger kids. But their kids aren't the only ones in schools. There's been concern about staff, teachers, and especially the substitute teacher, heavily represented by older demographics. What are some of the concerns about staffing and vulnerability?
Well, I think, and I don't want to pose at all as someone who's knowledgeable on medical and scientific stuff, but there's still so much that's not known about how the virus spreads and who can catch it. And sometimes you have cases where two people were very close together physically and one of them didn't catch it, and other times an entire class will catch it. So that uncertainty of who's going to catch it, yes, the incidence among older people And that can be anyone from above 20, especially above 40, and even more especially above 60, is a bigger deal than among young kids. I believe it's still accurate that there are no known deaths in Wisconsin among people who are under 20, although it's been a contributing factor in, I think, at least one case that I know of. Kids can spread it to people in a low-income community when we have lots of this in Milwaukee. There are many multi-generational homes where you've got grandparents and parents and kids and the worries about spread. You've got dense populations and the worries about spread. So nobody's immune to worrying.
Talking to Alan Borsuk. He's an education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School, talking about the tough decisions facing schools of how, when, whether to open for in-person instruction versus virtual or some combination. You can share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you want to see happen, what you are seeing maybe in your own district, where your kids go to school, where you work yourself. You can join in on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Alan, in a recent column, you say that the approach from schools is divided in a lot of ways on partisan lines around the state. What are we seeing?
I want to say clearly that whether this is just an observation or a causative thing is highly debatable. Sure. But yeah, the more urban districts, the lower income districts, and the districts with higher numbers of minority kids are much more likely to be virtual have been virtual since March 13th when schools closed. Rural areas, smaller cities, very likely to be 5 days a week at least, 5 days a week, or at least these hybrid schedules of 2 or 3 days a week. And it lines up very much along the political dividing lines we know so well in Wisconsin, Republicans and Democrats, Trump voters and Biden voters, rich and poor, and race. It's just you can't look at the maps of these things and not see so many ways of dividing Wisconsin, as many ways we are divided.
You wrote another piece about the Milwaukee School District and their approach to reopening, and you write that, in effect, they're kind of slow-walking the decision-making process. What do you see in there?
Well, I use that term. They met in October, late October, and the administration, Superintendent Keith Posley, proposed making preparations to open at least for young kids in the second half of January. And whether they would go ahead with that would be determined by circumstances then. And the school board didn't give that the time of day, frankly, even though the city health commissioner, who was part of the meeting, said it could be open safely. There's several dozen private schools in the city of Milwaukee that are open in person and within the kind of stresses and such that I said before have been making it through the year. And they put off even discussing it until late January. And the prospects for reopening in Milwaukee, in the Milwaukee public schools this year, I wouldn't want to make a bet on there being in-person classes between now and June. I'm guessing that there won't be. And that compares to even a lot of the big urban places in the country, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, others, where they are at least really pushing to get open and bring in at least the youngest kids, kindergartner, first, second, third, fourth grades, and special ed kids, and in some cases, kids with English language learning needs. Those are the priorities for bringing kids back. But here, and I should add, public opinion is highly divided statewide. In Milwaukee, I bet it's still a large majority of people, parents who don't want to send their kids in person. There's still a lot of fear, a lot of concern, and a lot of cases.
We're talking about the decision by some Wisconsin school districts to reopen their doors in the near future, or at least in process of trying to make that decision. Alan Borsuk is our guest, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support resuming in-person instruction? Are you worried about sending kids back to school and sending the grown-ups who work in schools back to those schools? what do you want to see happen maybe before your local district brings kids back in person? Or have you been in person in your part of the state all along? Parents, teachers, students, staff, tell us how you feel. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about whether it's time for school districts around Wisconsin to resume in-person classes or continue them, as some are. Public health officials in Dane County says it can be done safely. Chippewa Falls reopening January 4th. Others making their decisions, partial or total reopening. Alan Borsick stays with us, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can give your answer to some of those questions facing school district leaders. 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen in your local district? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Dave is with us in Sussex. Dave, hello.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Dave?
Well, I think that, of course, this is my opinion. Everybody has one. I think that the since the beginning of the COVID-19, the severity has been blown out of proportion, although it's dangerous for a very, 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 very small percentage of the population. The majority of the people are asymptomatic or not affected by it whatsoever, especially the kids. It's time to get the kids back to school. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And the severity is not as bad as people are making it out to be.
Dave, thanks for the call. And that's an argument we hear, I think, especially about schools and younger kids. On the other hand, 300,000 dead, and we're walking away from that number in the United States. How do you see districts weighing the severity, as Dave was talking about, and the risks they face in the schools?
Well, I don't know of anywhere in the country, even in the areas that have been most inclined to open schools, where they're not taking a case where, when a positive test comes back for a student or a teacher, where they're not taking that really seriously and quarantining kids. I think the mainstream health verdict and the mainstream verdict that schools are following is to take it really seriously when there is a positive case. I really don't have any numbers, that there's a trend toward trying to reopen once things get back after the holidays. Some of the big cities, more bipartisan support for that. Joe Biden says he wants schools to reopen if it can be done safely. Dr. Fauci says it can be done safely. A lot of state officials around the country and local health departments are saying it can be done safely, but it requires observing all of the rules we know so well now, masks and distancing, in the case of schools, ventilation and that kind of stuff, which makes, by the way, that's one of the reasons I think that there's some difference in geography here, is that suburban and rural districts, not every one, but many of them have more spacious buildings, newer buildings, just bigger classrooms. Urban districts, and Milwaukee certainly one of them, they have a lot of buildings that are 100 years old, 80, 85, 90 years old, and they're just not built the same way for spacing out students, for social distancing in a classroom. So it is harder in a place like Milwaukee than it would be in, frankly, Sussex. So everyone has their own take on how to proceed here.
Thanks for the call, Dave. We heard from Brandy on Facebook, who writes, has everyone gotten access to the vaccine? No, then it's too early. So the vaccine, being, on the horizon, maybe for wider use in the public, do you see school districts, Alan, looking at that and saying, okay, we just got to get through it until we get teachers and staff vaccinated and then we can reopen?
I don't know about the then we can reopen, but I think everyone's looking to the point where at least teachers have been vaccinated, and they're in not the very top priority group, but in kind of the second group, teachers and first responders and such. So teachers are likely to have some availability of it. I don't know how widespread it'll be relatively soon, but what does relatively soon mean? February? The notion that everyone, students and teachers, as well as family members, are going to be vaccinated before the end of the school year seems pretty unlikely. We're talking, you know, things I've been reading, more like May and June before there's really widespread vaccination.
Let's go back to a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. I was wondering if there's been any correlation between school districts that are in school teaching and the number of fatalities from COVID per capita, if there's anything that's been done. And I have to disagree a little bit with the thought that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. I don't want my elderly parents to be collateral damage simply, you know, for the lack of a few months of additional at-home schooling where the kids can keep separated and not be little, I guess, to use a peanuts term, pig pens running around spreading COVID everywhere. So in the spirit of the Christmas Snoopy and Charlie Brown, that just kind of comes to mind. But
gotcha. Thanks for the call, Mike. So as far as studies, I know, Alan, I've seen people trying to figure out if there's a correlation between schools opening and local COVID levels. I know people are watching Houston, for example, closely. I don't know if we have anything definitive on that yet, though. What are you looking at, if anything?
Well, nothing definitive, and there seems to be a lot of evidence that's not conclusive yet that spread within schools is not too common, particularly among kids. But spread outside of schools and then kids, you know, spreading it to each other, either in school or out, is pretty common. And, you know, every county in Wisconsin has had high to very high rates. I have some friends in Vilas County who thought they were in a safe place. And I said, you know, your per capita rate, this is several weeks ago, your per capita rate is only slightly below Milwaukee County, which was a factual statement at the time. So there are, I don't think there are very many havens, except staying home all the time, you know, which that's a personal choice and not a policy choice.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Alan Borsak, education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at school opening and reopening and in-person instruction decisions. Let's go to another caller now. Jan is with us in La Crosse. Jan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have some comments about reopening the schools. I'm a retired teacher who's been substituting, and I've actually been subbing every single day since September 1st. Right now, I'm at a school, and we just had two teachers last week whose parents died, and they could not find subs for either one of them. So I'm subbing for one teacher, but I ended up subbing for both teachers at the same time, and they had to call the school nurse to go sub for the other teacher. So what are they going to do if they open up the schools and people don't have the vaccine or the vaccination yet and they're not going to come in? And I've told them if they go in person, I'm not coming in until I've had the vaccine.
And Jan, just to be clear, you were subbing in virtual school.
Yes, I was subbing in virtual school.
Gotcha. So thanks for that call, Jan. Alan, how big is that a concern is that substitutes, for example, like Jan, retired teachers who virtual, they can do it? Jan says in person, not till I'm vaccinated.
Well, a lot of substitutes, a lot of districts draw on a pool of substitutes that is, as you said at the start of the program, disproportionately retired teachers, and that means they're not, you know, so young, and they're a higher risk population. So that's a legitimate issue. I made a round of calls several weeks ago to some Milwaukee suburban superintendents just to hear how they were doing. And the level of stress they were having just keeping teachers in classrooms, just keeping every classroom staffed, was really high. And this was in some cases in quite well-to-do districts. This wasn't just a low-income district thing. This was just, you know, a lot of teachers have been sick. A lot of teachers have been quarantining. It's just so stressful for all these people involved in the schools.
Thanks for sharing your story, Jan. Time for one more caller. Louise is on the line in Wausau. Louise, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Louise?
I wanted to tell you that our community has given parents a choice on whether they wanted to send their children in person or if they wanted to remain virtual. So our first quarter of school, their school was all virtual. And then for second quarter, parents had a choice. And so some of the students are remaining virtual and some are in person. And what we're finding with the kids that are in person, any COVID-related illnesses are occurring outside of the school setting. They are not occurring within school because we are practicing the six-foot distance. We're practicing the face masking and hand washing. And so when taking those precautions, we're finding we're not having a spread in school, but it's kids who have been exposed in the community, whether that's through sporting events, family gatherings, or things like that. And then other kids become exposed by being a close contact.
Louise, thanks for the call. Just a few moments left. Alan, maybe with partial reintroductions in the school, whether it's choice or just the younger kids or special needs students, schools can have some in person but allow for that space because they're not packing all the students in.
Well, two quick thoughts. One is there is a high priority pretty much everywhere, I think, on getting the youngest kids in because those are the ones who are hardest to reach in virtual teaching and most need to grow fast at this point. Second thought is every district, every private school, I think, that I know of has offered the option of virtual or in person. In some cases, they want you to choose one or the other and stick with it. But a large percentage of people have been choosing to keep their kids home. In some districts, it's 50, 60, 70%. In others, I know of one district in the Milwaukee area that has been as low as 15%. But in general, it's very high, especially in more urban districts.
We'll leave it there. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about how schools around the state are deciding whether to resume in-person classes or keep them going on. One of the things that makes the holidays special is togetherness. But with a global pandemic, the kind of get-togethers we're used to aren't an option for a lot of people. That's sad news on top of a year that's presented a lot of challenges to our mental and emotional well-being. But there's still some good news. Our next guests say there are still good ways to find joy and connection during the holiday season. They've got some advice on setting up a good mindset for a new style of holiday traditions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you mentally preparing yourself for the holidays this year? Are you putting a new spin on some of your old traditions? Do you have questions about how to deal maybe with guilt from family members over your decision to not see them in person? How are you seeing people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Karen Rivich is the Director of Training Programs for the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Karen, thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And James Pawelski is Professor of Practice and Director of Education in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, also an Adjunct Professor of Religious Studies in the School of Arts and Sciences there. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, Karen, I think a lot of us are coming into the holidays or into the last holidays, Thanksgiving, and so on, with a sense of loss, like, oh, I can't do the thing I was hoping to do. How do you recommend people try to recalibrate our mindsets to make a positive holiday?
So I think first it's important to not jump over the loss. Like, it's perfectly appropriate and helpful to acknowledge it, to feel it, and that's part of what makes us human. But then after you've acknowledged it, it's to sort of develop what I would describe as an optimistic mindset and to ask yourself the question, you know, what's the opportunity that this adversity affords me? What am I going to be able to do differently this year that might be something that I want to sustain in the future? And so that might be starting a new ritual. That might be reaching out to someone in a different way. But I think the most important thing is that we don't sort of pretend that things are the same and force ourselves to be happy without first acknowledging the suffering that a lot of us are feeling.
And James, as we acknowledge the downsides, it's kind of hard not to. How do we make sure we don't go to the opposite extreme then and wallow in them and feel like, well, that's it. Everything's ruined this year.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I just want to piggyback on what Karen said. As we've been thinking about various things over the course of this year, it's easy for us to think about, well, you know, we're just going to have half an apple this year. Like last year we had the whole apple, but this year it's just half an apple. And the more we thought about that, the more we thought, you know, that's not a very inspiring way of thinking about it. So we thought, how about if instead of that, we think, you know, it's not going to be half an apple. It's going to be an entire orange. It's something different. And so when you think of it that way, it's not so much about, oh, what can't we do this year that last year was great? And it's, well, okay, this year is new. It's different. We've never had a year like this before. And so that, as Karen said, putting on our optimistic mindset, we can say, well, what are the opportunities that arise as a result of it? I know my family, we're connecting over Zoom, but my mom said the last time we connected, she's like, you know, we're actually connecting a lot more this way than we have been when, you know, when we were able to travel to meet each other, but it takes a lot of effort to make that journey.
And Karen, how about, you know, we've got a lot of families have that cherished tradition that goes along with a particular holiday. How can we find ways to, you know, put a new spin on a tradition that we can't recreate in person?
Yeah, that's important. I mean, for me, I think one of the questions is, what's the emotion that tradition brings? So if it's, you know, baking cookies together with your extended family and you can't do that, what's the feeling you get when you're baking the cookies? And how can you design a different tradition that's, you know, pandemic approved that brings that same emotion? And so, you know, in our family, you know, one of the emotions that we like to share together is sort of like this, a deep appreciation of beauty. And the ways that maybe we did that in the past are harder to do this year, but we can design new activities, like we each go out and take a walk and take a photograph of something that just like fills us with joy and beauty and text that picture to each other. And so that's sort of gratifying the emotion that's so meaningful to us, but it's doing it in a way that makes sense this year. And I guess I like what James said. It's sort of it's making an orange. And, you know, in our family, some of these new traditions are going to be traditions that we stick with because we've challenged ourselves to sort of think more deeply about why we do the things we do and how do they help us as a family sort of connect. And those are things that we'll keep doing in the future.
We're talking to Karen Rivich and Jane Powelski from the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about how to keep holidays special, even if we can't celebrate them, you know, with a big group in person, maybe the way we usually hopefully look forward to. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How did you tackle maybe Thanksgiving? What are your plans for Christmas or other holidays coming up? What have you done to make birthdays special when you can't get together in person? I would love to hear your solutions. The more creative, the better. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. James, Karen was talking about the emotions we attach to those get-togethers. And, you know, there's kind of a ritual feel, even if it isn't really, you know, super structured like a church ritual or a graduation. But, you know, there's things you always do. How can we recreate that, say, in an online meeting so it feels like it's something special, not just another Zoom call?
Yeah, so a couple things I would say. First, if I might, I just want to piggyback on something specific that Karen said. She mentioned photography and sharing photos with each other. And that's actually really closely connected with some research that we've been doing as part of the Humanities and Human Flourishing Project that I direct at the Positive Psychology Center. And we've done surveys of asking people how they've been coping in the pandemic times. And what we find is people who use the arts to cope with COVID fare better. That coping mechanism is associated with pretty much every aspect of well-being. So in other words, people who are using photography, music, art in these times of the coronavirus, that is associated with all kinds of well-being outcomes. So we you mentioned church, religious rituals. They oftentimes, almost always involve music, art, sacred texts, and so forth. So if you can't engage in those things as you normally would, you can't go to the art museum if that's what you like to do with your family, take some photographs. You can't maybe go to a live concert. Well, there are things, there are still ways that you can engage with music. And some of those things you can do over Zoom as well. You can share links to things that you appreciate over Zoom as well. But keeping the arts, literature, those things, keep and tweak, we like to say. But keeping those in the rituals, I think, would be very important.
And that, Karen, it sounds like it would take some advanced planning. Can you talk about how we can maybe get together, use our creativity to prepare for this unusual gathering so that some cool stuff like James was talking about comes out of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's important to stress is that we're a resilient bunch, that all of us have within us the tools that we need to navigate adversity. And the tools I might use to navigate adversity might be different than the tools you use. But I think the first sort of most basic question we can ask ourselves is, in the past when I've gone through hard things, what's helped me to get through this difficult patch? How have I stayed connected to the people that matter most to me? Because one of the things that we know from a lot of the research around resilience and well-being is that strong relationships or connected to something larger than oneself is foundational in this. And so I think the first step is to not think that you're having to make this all up now, that to look to your own history and say, how have I gotten through difficult patches before, and how do I apply that now? And maybe that is, you know, planning in advance some activities that you know are going to be fun with the family. Maybe it's journaling as a way to sort of have some private reflection and connect to what's meaningful to you about the holidays. But I think it starts with tapping in to what resides within each of us that helps us to cope, and then extending it to this current situation.
We're talking to Karen Rivich and James Pawelski from the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. They're giving us some advice on how to find joy during an unusual holiday season. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How are you altering your holiday traditions this year? Are you doing something special, if different, for a holiday get-together? How did you handle Thanksgiving? Lessons learned? What do you want to do different, maybe Christmas or New Year's? In general, are you doing different fun stuff on the holidays to find some joy in a tough time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Karen Rivich and James Pawelski from the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at ways to find joy this holiday season. Even if we can't get together in person, you can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are your plans for holiday gatherings to replace maybe your usual get-together? Have you done something creative with Thanksgiving or with birthdays up to now? Maybe you can share lessons learned with us. 800-642-1234, or send an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. James, I've been focusing on that, you know, holiday day actual get-together. Are there things we know that can help build our resilience in general that we might try to tackle during this holiday season in a tough time?
Well, I think one temptation is to put everything onto one day, like, oh, this is the holiday, and so this is the day that's going to be perfect, and this is the day when everything is going to go smoothly, and we're going to feel all those warm, fuzzy feelings and so forth, and hopefully we do. But, you know, let's be honest. We've all had holidays where the day itself wasn't necessarily what it was cracked up to be, or we were disappointed in this aspect or that, or it didn't just quite work out. So I think that one thing that's important is not to, the good old days weren't necessarily as perfect as we sometimes remember them, and so it's important to remember that even in those times of celebration, there are still times when we feel disconnected so that's one thing. But then secondly, we can practice those aspects of relationships, of gratitude, of savoring, of thinking about when we, you know, what is it that allows us to be resilient more than just on the holidays. So, for example, with my family, I've organized Zoom calls, I mentioned. So every 2 weeks, we spend an evening on the Zoom together. And that itself has created this ritual, and it's allowed us to dig more deeply into our relationships with each other. Sometimes when we're actually physically together, there's so much going on that it's hard to sit down and actually have a deep conversation with someone. But when you're sitting in front of a screen, it allows you to connect in sometimes more deeply. So we've certainly experienced that in our own family. So we've been able to have those really strong feelings of connection and love for each other, even when it isn't, you know, the exact holiday on the calendar.
And Karen, I know I've heard our resilience in tough times can actually be helped by helping out others. Are there thoughts on how philanthropy, even at a small scale, can help us get through tough times?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that's important about this. So one is that one of the bedrocks of resilience is taking purposeful action. So that when a person engages in action that's aligned with their goals and their values, they're demonstrating to themselves that they're not helpless. And when you demonstrate to yourself that you're not helpless, you're building efficacy, you're building a belief system that you have what it takes to be able to cope and persevere, or sometimes just endure something difficult. And so one of the things that's really great about helping other people is that you're doing two things at once. One, you're taking purposeful action. And so you're sending yourself very, very clear messages that you have the ability to make positive change. The other thing that you're doing, of course, when you're helping other people is that you're helping other people. And so you're strengthening your relationships. And even if it's people that you're not going to interact with again, you're creating and feeding the very important belief system that we're all in this together. And so those two things, taking action that's aligned with your values and creating for yourself and for other people connection so that we feel like we're tethered to each other, we're not lost at sea, that goes such a long way in helping us to have the energy to persevere. I mean, one of the things I just wanted to add about what enables what we can all be doing to sort of keep our resilience muscles strong during this time is to like listen to what we're saying to ourselves. So I teach optimism, but I am a natural pessimist, and I have had to learn to tune into what I say to myself in the moment and ask myself the question, is what I'm saying to myself right now helping me, or is it getting in my way? And we can all do that. We can listen to our internal dialogue. And if the answer is, it's not helping me right now, I'm just complaining, or I'm getting sort of lost in pessimism, I, like everyone, can change that dialogue. And by changing the dialogue, I'm building optimism, I'm building efficacy, and that drive, that's the engine of my resilience. And that's something that all of us can be doing.
James, I remember even in normal years, there's concern about people feeling loneliness over the holidays, maybe people living alone or at a senior center for the first time when they, you know, used to be closer to family. What are some ways we can make sure we're helping people around us by staying in contact with people who need that contact themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It's easy, oddly, or perhaps ironically, over the holidays to get so wrapped up in having the perfect experience ourselves and then perhaps being happy or disappointed that it didn't happen exactly as we wanted it. But I think it is important to take time to think about other people and the experiences that they're having. And it can be so much more meaningful and enjoyable in a lot of ways too. And in fact, isn't that what the season is about? Reaching out to other people, letting them know, as Karen was saying, that we're connected, that we care, that we see, we hear each other. So I would challenge every one of us to think, you know, just take one person who we know their circumstances changed this year, perhaps, and reach out to that person and just let them know that we're thinking of them, that they are loved, and that we care about them, and they're part of this holiday as well.
Talking to James Pawelski and Karen Rivich from the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the best ways to find some joy over the holiday season. Karen, with the whole not getting together thing, I know some families, everybody's on board. Yes, we shouldn't get together. Let's do what we can online. it's a point of conflict in some families where some people want to get together anyway. Do you have thoughts on how to help somebody facing that pushback, maybe from a loved one, about trying to spin this, to sell this as a potentially positive experience without getting together?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would, I'm not sure I would describe it as selling it, but I do think, you know, having difficult conversations is something that a lot of us do, you know, daily, and certainly that comes up a lot around the holidays. And I think one of the things that makes difficult conversations go better is when you and the other person can align around a shared value. And so if you're somebody in your family wants to be with you, but you don't feel safe because of COVID, starting the conversation by anchoring to something that you know is important to both of you, and whether that's health or a feeling of trust and knowing that you can be honest with each other. But starting the dialogue or the conversation by saying, look, I know you care about your health and my health, and I do too. And that's why I think it's really important that we, you know, do this over Zoom versus around the dinner table. But thinking ahead of time about what is that shared value and being transparent about that in the conversation often makes bad news and hard conversations go more smoothly. And it communicates that you're in it together, that you're on the same team, not that it's you and this other person against each other.
James, as we start to wrap up, I know we have probably a lot of lessons in resilience from tough situations in the past pandemics or disasters or economic tough times. Are there lessons you'd draw from to share with people in this particular manifestation of tough times?
Well, I think what Karen said earlier about learning from, you know, drawing on what has gotten us through the past is really important. And, you know, this will become the past in the not too distant future. And so one way of thinking about these days is specifically, as I said, this is something new. This is an orange. So what can we learn from this experience? How can we remain optimistic, as Karen said? How can we be open to the lessons that in a year's time, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, we're going to look back and say, ah, that was something, that was a tough time, but we got through it. I think it's also really important, not just for ourselves, but for our kids who are modeling their response to these times based on how we respond to it. So if we're devastated and in a downward spiral because we don't, things aren't working the way we wish they were, that communicates to them that outside circumstances can dictate our lives. But if we can instead even work with them to say, you know, partner with them. What is it about these days that we can rely on? How can we manage and learn and grow? Then that can be something that will create memories that we can look back on in the future. When families get together and talk, when friends get together and talk, it's oftentimes about, you remember that tough time, you remember that hardship. And so this will be able to fuel a lot of connections for years to come.
Well, we'll leave it there. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been great to be with you.
And Karen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Karen Rivich, Director of Training Programs for the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and James Pawelski, Professor of Practice and Director of Education at the Positive Psychology Center. They talked to us about how to find joy in the holiday season, even when usual traditions have been disrupted. Got a late-breaking email from Allison who says, for Christmas, my six-year-old is giving a concert over Zoom of Christmas carols he's learned this year on the keyboard. This is something we would not do in person because we would not be lugging the keyboard with us to the grandparents' house where we usually go for the holidays. Well, a great example of what our guests were talking about, trying to find ways to take advantage of the unique situation. Thanks, Allison, for that email.